This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I was writing these articles like about the zoo or about rubber or about like convenience stores, just because I'm fascinated by that subject. And here at Saguenay, our whole philosophy we're very lucky to have is if you're interested in it, if you're a nerd about it, if it gets you excited, write it. It'll find an audience. You know, people will connect. And if they don't, the very few that it connects with, it'll hopefully will be a profound connection because you're profoundly connected to it. My name is Paul Christensen. I'm an American who's writing and editing in Saigon.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
From an outsider's perspective, how do you think being Vietnamese has changed since you've arrived for, you know, all these years?
When I first came to Vietnam, the concept of Vietnamese or Vietnam was a relative blank slate. Where I'm from originally in the States, we don't have a Vietnamese American community or any diaspora that I would have anything to base my concept of Vietnamese on. So it was kind of encountering it all at once. For the first time in 2005, and then I moved here in 2015, and I've been here since then. And so it's my understanding of what it means to be Vietnamese kind of grows and evolves the longer I stay here, and influences me during that time to be more flexible, more outgoing, I think, kind of in response to what I see around me, to the flexibility, the openness, and the generosity of the people that I encounter.
You arrived in Vietnam in 2005, you said?
Yeah, so when I was an undergraduate student, I did a semester abroad in East Asia. So I went to China, Thailand, and spent about a month and a half here in Vietnam. And that was my first introduction to the country and kind of put a flag in my mind of like, okay, I need to come back here in a much more thorough, deep way when I'm able. And it took a while, but yeah, finally was able to move here in 2015.
But why Vietnam and not another country like Thailand or any other country you visited? Why Vietnam?
It would be probably exaggeration to say that Vietnam was always, you know, this place that I had a gold star next to. I'm going to come here no matter what. But it wasn't exactly that. I did, after I graduated from college, I lived in Japan for a couple of years. And when I finally had an opportunity to finish graduate school and wanted just kind of time to explore and adventure, Vietnam seemed like the perfect place. Just from kind of what I'd always remembered about it. And then just the subtle ways Vietnam kept coming across my life. I remember like reading literature, Ocean Vuong and Viet Thanh Nguyen right around that time were kind of really getting mainstream attention, and their names kept coming. I'm like, ah, maybe this is a sign that I need to figure out what's going on over there and take a look.
What was going on over there or over where you are in Vietnam? What was going on that drew you to it?
Seeing how so many exciting projects or initiatives or just people were able to have an idea, have an interest, have a spark, and just run with it and just pursue what they wanted to pursue and share it and get a lot of energy behind it, a lot of often youthful energy behind what they were interested in a way that maybe in the States I didn't see happening as much. It was a little more, you have to go through official channels. There's a way to do everything. This is kind of the routine. This is the trajectory. You get in line and you follow the trajectory. And there was a little bit more freedom to just do what you wanted to do and figure out how you want to do it.
It's so ironic. The two things so far, we're like a few minutes into our episode here, and we're talking about the Yellow Star and freedom. These
yeah,
are...
I know. Bet unintended totally. Metaphor.
But it's great. It's great because it gives us some fodder, right, to talk about right now. Because I can imagine, you know, I come with a lot of political baggage. I think when I'm just being me, thinking about my road and my inroads to, you know, Vietnamese thinking, because there's this kind of polar opposites of like being outside, being inside, and there's no neutrality sort of in where I come from. But when I talk to somebody like you, and you know, I want to shout out to Chi Phan Quy Mai, Nguyen Phan Quy Mai, author of The Mountain Sings, and she introduced us. So I was like, okay, this is a very strong connection. And we sat in Saigon a few months ago, and there's this deep connection, and I realize how much you love Vietnam. And I'm like, I would love to have you on the podcast. And here we are. This is here. But the reason I bring all this stuff up is because, you know, you come in with a clean slate, basically. You don't have any expectations or any color other probably than the war, you know, wherever you're from, you probably can say, you know, there's this kind of image of Vietnam. But for the most part, I think, you know, you come in relatively kind of with an open mind. And I want to spend this episode talking about all the wonderful perspectives that you have because of the things that you've worked on. You wrote for Saigoneer for many years, and content director today. And you've done so much in the Vietnamese literary world in Vietnam. So you offer a lot of perspective that I'm really curious, and I'm fascinated with your journey. And you're a young person that have, you know, spent so much years in Vietnam. So it's very, your perspective is very valuable to me, and I want to hear a lot about the way you think.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I'm so honored, and thank you again for having me on and talking. It's really a thrill.
Yeah, you're very honest. And I think when we talk, it's just like, whoa. And then there's layers. And then I read up more about you. And I'm like, whoa, there's a lot going on here. So I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, thank you. I think you're absolutely right about blank slate. And I think it's a great privilege that I can come here with a blank slate, especially, you know, I'm 36. My parents weren't involved in the war. No, I don't have any family members. So growing up, Vietnam really, other than the what, like 4 days in history class in 10th grade or whatever it was, really was not something I was introduced to form any impressions until I was in university, until I came here for the first time. Yeah. And that extends even while I'm here, I think, of people will talk to me regardless of their backgrounds, their political stances, their geographical backgrounds, because they can't say to me like, oh, you are, you know, a southerner, oh, you are a northerner, oh, your family is this, oh, your family is that. I'm just can be kind of an individual and a blank vessel to be filled with whatever they want to share. So I think that is an extreme blessing that I am fortunate to have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's so many Vietnamese people living outside of Vietnam that really don't care about Vietnamese literature. You know, they just don't think about it. Because they have to survive, they have to make money, and they're enjoying the money making, or they're enjoying whatever field they're in. But to really study and to be a part of this Vietnamese literature scene, you know, it's very special. And I want to talk about, how did you get into this world, and how did you get into this work?
Yeah, I mean, my background and kind of passion is literature. Poetry particular, and also fiction. I just grew up loving to read. And then at some point I was fortunate enough to find out, oh, I can continue studying that. I can go get a master's degree in poetry. And, you know, I was doing this all for fun, and was lucky enough that I could continue pursue it with the knowledge very much in my mind that this is probably not a great financial career decision to do. But if you love it, life's too short to not give yourself a chance to get as deep as possible into something that one loves. So when I came to Vietnam, I just finished graduate school, and I came here and was lucky enough, I guess, to have something I'm passionate about help me integrate initially and like explore and understand, because there's no better way, in my opinion, to really learn about people and learn about places in history than reading about it. I mean, movies are good. Talking to people is, of course, essential, but really reading it offers a special intimacy. So reading it was selfishly helping me to understand the country better, helping understand and connect with people in a much more fruitful way, I think. And then just over time, getting to know people, having the benefit of writing for Saguenay, which is an arts and culture, history, literature publication online, gave me kind of an easy in of approaching writers that I like and not just saying, hey, I'm a fan, I'd love to talk to you, but hey, I'm a fan, I'd love to talk to you, and I will write an article, which was kind of an easy way to have that excuse to start a conversation, which conversations turn into friendships, friendships turn into collaborations, introductions to other people. I mean, that's how we met, from Chi Kwai Mai introduced us. I knew her because I'd read her poems years ago and just cold called her. So it kind of all snowballs. And I think the most important part of that is I think it's all from a love of literature and of each other's work, because nobody's getting rich off of it. Nobody's, you know, there's no promotional potential really of any great value. It's because you love it and you like to discuss it with people that share that passion and that energy.
Yeah, and that's what I recognize about you. You know, there's a purity to the love of what you're doing. And I recognize it. Yeah, you're right. There's nobody's getting rich off this stuff, and nobody will, you know. Yeah. But look at you, Kwai Mai now. I mean, God almighty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. And absolutely, it could not happen to a more generous, like, warm person. And she's the exact same now as she was before it happened. So it's so cool to see.
But I mean, isn't that sort of the way this magic works? Is like, because she's generous, because she's so giving with her time and her energy and her responses, it's put her in the space where, I mean, let's put her talent aside. I mean, just being that warm, energetic human being has, you know, it really does pay dividends to be that naturally giving.
Oh yeah. And I think her generosity of just, if somebody, even once things started blowing up, you know, she'd get calls for just a school group or a book club that said, hey, can you Skype in? And you're, you know, in an opposite time zone. Yep, she would do it, you know, every single time. And that, yeah, that generosity, I think.
Yeah, that generosity
has ripple effects.
Yeah, it's insane. Well, that brings me to, first of all, let's talk this idea of bridging, right? So you have said that, or you've really made a big effort to kind of bring Vietnamese writers to the outside and to America, or to the Americans, and vice versa. You've brought, you know, you've talked about, you know, Vietnamese writers in the diaspora back into Vietnam and be this bridge. How did that work start?
Little bit by little bit. And it is definitely the most thrilling part and kind of where I see that I can have the most effect. You know, as a writer, I'm one drop into a very full pool, especially if I'm publishing things in America. But if I'm bringing, you know, a collection of Vietnamese writers over to America, that's one of not very many collections that'll exist. So that has, I think, a large potential to impact people. And it's through just time of connections, really, of getting to know people, having connections in the American literature scene just from my time there, and now having been here long enough to have friends that write and friends that publish, and kind of those informal means, which I personally always really hated for a long time. I thought it's art and the artist should be separated as much as possible. Not about, you know, is the personal life good, but in terms of, I was publishing under pen names because I didn't want, if they were friends with me, that they would select my work because we're friends. You know, it's the art only. It's only what I've written. Judge it 100% on that. Which I've learned is kind of a naive way to approach it. And really, at the end of the day, friendships and connections are helpful, if not necessary, sometimes. So as I've kind of, one thing I've learned from being here in Vietnam and having those connections and seeing how it's not about using them to get things places. It's about collecting your energies together and doing together what you couldn't do as any one individual.
Wow. So you grew up with meritocracy idea of, you know, the work needs to speak for itself name.
Yeah, that's what that was kind of my big whole idea for a long time. And I'm glad it's changed. I'm glad that I've learned about it.
But sometimes though, the writing isn't so great, but the artist or the writer might have gotten to where because of special connections. I mean, that happens everywhere, not just in Vietnam, but is that okay? Like, is there anything wrong with that?
I mean, right. That's a slippery slope, right? You go too far and that's what you have happen. You have people that work that's not that good getting attention based on connections or past work or big names or money can factor in at some point. Yeah. I mean, behind that kind of stuff happens, you know, and it's a slippery slope. And I think if your choice is complete meritocracy to ensure that that never happens, you lose things.
Yeah.
But you leave the door open also if you do welcome in the role of relationships beside the work. So it's tricky. It's tricky to find that balance. And I think every individual has to kind of decide where they lie and what's okay for them. And it's messy, but I think it's the best way maybe.
Yeah. I mean, nothing's black and white, but yeah, you're right. It's messy, but we have to navigate and figure things out like that. You know, you were a Fulbright scholar, right? And is that what brought you to Vietnam or no?
Yeah. So, the Fulbright grant was just a teaching. So they put you in a gifted high school and everyone is different a little bit. And so that's why I came to Vietnam and we got the kind of email saying I picked Vietnam, but I didn't get to choose within Vietnam where I'd go. And I got an email saying, you know, you're going to go to Quy Nhơn. And I had to Google where that is and see the big, you know, horseshoe beach. I'm like, okay, I think this will be okay. And I was absolutely blessed by the situation. And the school I was at was wonderful because their philosophy was, you know, we don't have foreign teachers that have, you know, vetted academic backgrounds or, you know, quote unquote, like esteemed ability or however they want to say, whatever. So we're just going to give them the opportunity to learn from you, whatever you want to teach them. So you'll have a couple hours a week with the students and you can do whatever you want. And I was worried I was going to be like, you know, flashcard English teachers. And one of the first days the student raises his hand, he goes, yeah, what's the difference between licentiousness? And I'm like, what? I'm like, okay, if you know that word, like, we don't need to do English. We're going to learn about haiku this week. We're going to have you guys, you know, write little plays and perform them. We're going to have you tell stories, just whatever they want to do. And a little bit to let them be teenagers and have fun. And
that's amazing.
But yeah, that's how I first arrived here was through the Fulbright.
And how long were you in Quy Nhơn for?
A year. So I was there for a year placement.
You know, that's a beautiful beach town, right?
Yeah, it's a gorgeous place.
Underrated.
Underrated. I'd say get there now because like I was just there a few weeks ago actually to see some of my former students that had also gone back for a trip. And it's coming. The changes are coming. They can point out like, oh, this plot of land got bought up by Novaland. Oh, this place has got bought up by here. So they're not constructed yet, but it's changing, but it's gorgeous as it is now.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, still untapped, relatively untapped. How does that make you feel watching? It's a bittersweet transformation to me.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'm always kind of uncertain because it's one reaction for me as an outsider that appreciates it for certain reasons. But so I tried to talk to a lot of my former students and their families and be like, what do you guys think? Like, this is your hometown. This your opinion is much more important and grounded than mine is. And they kind of had similar of bittersweet of like, you know, it's sad when your childhood home where all your great memories are. It's sad when that changes. Change is sad in general. But then they'll also say for a lot of people, it's been really good for bringing in money and making families' lives that were pretty difficult easier and helping in that financial way. So they kind of see both sides. But bittersweet.
Yeah, and Vietnam's just transforming so quickly.
It's incredible.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about this quite often. People here in the U.S., Vietnamese Americans, my parents' generation have never been back, and they still think people are having very and people are, I'm sure, are off, the majority of the country is having a difficult time. But that difficulty is not what the difficulty 30, 40 years, or even 50 years used to be. It's difficult, but it's still like difficult. People are still on smartphones. It's there's a level
Yeah.
to it's not as difficult as we think it is. It's difficult, but it's not difficult, right?
Yeah. Do they believe you when you tell them about the changes, or do they think like, no,
They
you're
don't want to
making
hear
that
it.
up?
They don't want to hear it. And I think there's a sense of hurt. I think people of that generation lost a lot, and I sympathize. I can empathize with that, and I can totally understand. My brother was talking to me about this. We at this point, I think politically, or if it's a generational thing, we don't want to. I don't want, and he doesn't want us to lose family members or friends for these things, because it's like, how do they just don't know what they don't know, right?
Yeah.
Somebody like you, someone like my brother who's been living there for 20 years, and I go back two, three times a year, we just know, and there's no way you can argue with somebody who just doesn't know. So instead of like really alienating the whole community or these older generation people, I'm learning now to just sit in the discomfort, sit in the uncomfortable silence of the disagreeing part, and just kind of like accept it and let them be, instead of losing them.
Yeah. Right. If those are your two options, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, changing people's minds about communism or whatever capitalist structures that is sort of semi in existence in Vietnam now. It's like, how do you explain that to people who are non-believers?
Yeah. Yeah. And if they've spent 30 years coming to their opinions, good luck
Good
trying
luck.
to change it in any way.
I want to shift over to the zoo, the Saigon Zoo.
Yeah.
This was something that you wrote, right? The essay that you wrote.
Yeah.
You wrote a lot of interesting things, and my connection to the zoo is through Stefan Gauger's film Owl and the Sparrow. I think he
Yeah,
shot it in
great.
2008 or 9, wrote it around that time. And while I was reading your piece, it just really brought me back to the memories of the stories that he told me as he was shooting the film, The Owl and the Sparrow. So that's sort of our
That's so
connection.
cool. And that we were talking before we started recording, but I love that movie. And I've never heard anybody else or had the chance to talk to anybody else about it. And it's so cool. It's a beautiful movie. It's gorgeous. And then especially within the context of I personally can go and see this, the location and see all the places those scenes came from is
How
fantastic.
did you come across the film?
I honestly can't remember. It was a few years ago. I want to say Netflix, but I mean, you would maybe know better than I would if it was on Netflix. It might not have been. It might have been on YouTube. It might have even been on one of the other pirate sites out there. I honestly don't even know how it came. I mean, I would do cursory searches for Vietnamese movies, and it came up on something.
And did you watch the movie before you wrote that, or did you watch it after? Did you watch it after or before you wrote that piece?
Well, before I think I might have even watched it before I moved to Saigon when I was still living in Quy Nhon. So it had been a while. Probably I don't know if I've watched it again since I started going to the zoo frequently. I want to now. Because yeah, it's been a few years since I watched that movie. I watched it twice, but a while ago.
Yeah. Why is this even important that we're talking about the zoo? And I'm gonna just kind of prompt it, and then I will kind of give you my two cents on why it's important. It's important that
Yeah,
we talk about the
I'm
zoo right now because of what you said in your piece about history and about sucking resources out of Vietnam during those years, and the zoo is not what it's not what we think it is, you know? So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that kind of theme of sucking resources out of Vietnam comes up time and time again as a researcher, learn about more things. And of course, the very obvious ones on the forefront that, you know, whether it's opium production, of course, in colonial times, or even resources like rubber or coffee production. Those are pretty obvious, easy to see the connection. And you're not really that surprised when you hear that, like, France, you know, tried to plant rubber here to get money from the colonies because they weren't making money otherwise. But then you start seeing it in much subtler, smaller, more surprising areas, like rice wine, how that whole thing functioned. But the zoo. So the zoo was originally, the botanical gardens half of that name is very important. And it was kind of a training ground for what outside or internal plants could be grown here successfully with purely commercial purposes. You know, what can we grow cotton here? I don't know, let's try it in our botanical gardens and see how it goes. And so using it as like a staging ground in a lot of ways to see what could be grown and exported.
And was that a French government program?
Yeah. So it was a few of the kind of bigger names amongst the colony were kind of given that as their playground. And I'm sure there were people involved that really were not, you know, hardened capitalists who were just focused on making money. That to be able to care for plants or animals, they were certainly still passionate about that field. But that was kind of the purpose for the zoo lurking behind the surface.
Yeah. And how well is the zoo maintained today?
I would say not great. Ironically, the people that need the money might have, or want the money might have changed over the last little more than a century, but the need for the zoo to make money remains, unfortunately. So over time, even in the, you know, half dozen years I've been here, they've slowly added kid amusement rides, restaurants, like teen zones, to try and make money from the zoo, which kind of impacts that's the priority for a lot of it, as opposed to the care of the grounds or the care of the animals. Yeah. So it's, and of course, I mean, zoos are complicated. Zoos are messy in terms of animal welfare. And then that spirals out to larger human impact on the globe and stewardship of the planet. So it's a tangled, messy topic.
It really is. And you're not a zoo professional, but since we're on the topic, how many zoos are there in Vietnam? Do you know?
I would guess about probably a half dozen. There's a big one in Hanoi. Saigon's is kind of the biggest and definitely the oldest. And then some of the smaller towns, cities have them. I mean, Phu Quoc has one, Nha Trang has one, Quy Nhơn has one. I imagine some of the other cities throughout the country do as well.
Yeah, you wrote something really horrifying or really sad about baby cubs, allegedly 2 decades ago.
Yeah, that I was told by that story by a former, he's retired now, but he worked for like the state forestry and his friends with a former director of the zoo. And at the time, one of the tigers had given birth to cubs, which we think would be like fantastic, right? That's a reason for celebration, because you not only whatever metaphorical purpose or whatever, but they have value to bring people in or to help spread knowledge of the animal kingdom, get people excited about the animal kingdom, or if need be, send them to other zoos to help propagate the species. But they were just too expensive, apparently, to raise, to feed. And so they got killed, they got drowned. Which is horrifying.
Yeah. What more can they do? You know, it's that technology to probably raise these cubs are just way beyond anybody's pay grade. You know.
Yeah. And it's tough. I will say one of the kind of heartwarming stories when it comes to the zoo was during the pandemic, when Saigon, obviously, like the rest of the world, was hit pretty hard, and the zoo, which still relies a lot of money on entrance tickets, asked for donations, or let it be known that they were open to donations, might be more accurate. And people just flooded in. Local people just absolutely overwhelmed their expectations for money that they could get from the community. And my thinking is that it's a lot of people who just have sentimental connections to the zoo that really appreciate it, that they grew up and their parents took them there on one of their few family days out, or they take their kids there on one of the few Saturdays that they have free as a family to go, or they have, you know, fond memories of young romance at the zoo or going with their buddies. And it was surprising to see how much that meant to the greater Saigon or Vietnam community. That was good to hear.
Well, you know, that zoo is positioned in a very amazing place in the city. It's like almost Central Park if you think about it, right?
Yeah. And it forms that kind of that long corridor. You've got the palace on one side, and then it just goes straight over right to the zoo. And it's just this great runway of sorts of trees.
Yeah. And so I can imagine, you know, young couples going in there because there's just so much to walk around and see. Like, yeah, it's like, it's kind of like their Central Park, but with animals.
Yeah, it really is. And that's one thing I try and tell people is, if you have qualms, and probably justifiable very much so, about animals being kept there and conditions of animals, go there to enjoy the park. It's one of the best collections of trees and grasses and water in central Saigon. So it's, as a park, it's fantastic too for that.
You know, so the book that you gave me is the anthology, right? So, you know, I picked up the book, and so you open it up and half of it is in Vietnamese, and then you flip the book over and then you start turning it and it's in English, the translation. Tell me about the book. Tell me about how you...
Yeah. So the book started, I was writing these articles like about the zoo or about rubber or about like convenience stores, just because I'm fascinated by that subject. And here at Saigoneer, our whole philosophy, we're very lucky to have, is if you're interested in it, if you're a nerd about it, if it gets you excited, write it. It'll find an audience. You know, people will connect. And if they don't, the very few that it connects with, it'll hopefully will be a profound connection because you're profoundly connected to it. So I'm very blessed to have that kind of attitude allowing me to explore these things. So I was just writing them for Saigoneer, and then my friend, who's the translator, pen name, purposefully unpronounceable pen name, if you look at it, people think it's a misspelling, but she also goes by Luna or Chanting, incredible woman, fascinating story. She was becoming well known as a fiction writer in Saigon pre-76, and continued, and it's her life story to tell, so I won't expand beyond that, but we became friends, and we get together for dinner, just chatting, often united around literature and talking about books. And we're nerds, so we would just translate and co-translate things together. She would read my essays on Saigoneer and we'd just translate them, or she's a fiction writer, so she'd have her short stories and kind of do a loose translation into English, and I would just touch up the edges, or we talk about them, and we were just kind of playing with translations and playing with each other's work because we like it and it's fun. And some other kind of writer friends who have connections with publishers or publish a lot themselves had done all these translations, put them together and publish it. And so, okay, that's not why we were doing this, but sure, let's do it. So we kind of fell into it. And we're lucky enough to have people that wanted to help promote it and push us to be like, do something with this. Don't just keep doing these for fun.
Well, I have a lot of appreciation for your nerding out. And I look at all the topics that you tackle, and I'm one of the people that is fiercely interested in all of these topics. Now, not one of them do I go, no, I skip. And I wrote them all down because we could spend hours per topic talking about the history of rice wine, well worship, in defense of Saigon's most neglected museums, the rubber plantations, Lục Bình, which is hyacinth as an invasive species. And so, like I said, we can nerd out, and because these are all very, these are all topics that I want to talk about. And sort of like the way I look at my podcast is the same thing. It's like, well, you know, I got to give the House of Hoes, I got to give the room there to do its thing because it's part of Vietnamese pop culture. But at the same time, I want to talk and give attention to the subjects that we just talked about. So we finished the zoo topic, and I want the next thing, if we can talk about the history of rice wine a little bit. So I kind of do want to touch on all these topics, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so cool to hear. Now I can imagine, like, thinking of new ideas, like, oh, what do you think about this? Ah, he would like it. Let's go. You know, to hear that people are excited about it means so much.
Yeah. So yeah, talk to me about the history of rice wine. We don't have to get into the weeds, but just want to hear it from you.
Yeah, I think like all the topics just kind of came up because I either found a sliver of something, heard something, or was just interested in it. And I think, you know, enough times going to people's houses and being invited to try their homemade rice wine, coming from the American perspective, where you don't really get a lot of moonshine. I mean, no, like people craft, make their own beer now is kind of a new trend, yeah, for sure. But people don't really make liquor and hand it to you in a, you know, repurposed plastic bottle very often. So I was just fascinated, like what's going on here? And there's been some academic stuff written about it. And so between that and talking to people, talking to friends' parents who were doing it, got to learn a little bit more and was just shocked by, again, going into themes of resource theft pretty much and influence, but also how rice wine clashed with modernity in the sense of imported wines, imported cognacs, and how the power to frame one as foreign and extravagant and rice wine is nakwe and undesirable, mm-hmm, and how those play out even today, how we see the effects of previous colonial depictions of local wine still having an impact today, I found was fascinating. And then now kind of a nice trend seeing it coming back and seeing, you know, hip cool bars in Saigon is a lot really emphasizing their homemade rice wine that they make into fancy cocktails and stuff, and kind of seeing it come whole circle at least is a nice happy ending, because otherwise it's a pretty depressing story about how they tried to take away Vietnamese ability to make and enjoy their own liquor and profit from it.
But that's a story of people in poverty everywhere, right? Like I think of, like, I don't know, I associate it naturally, you know, maybe 10 years ago when I think of Rude is what we're talking about, right? I think of Appalachian, you know, the Appalachian people in America and the Appalachians, you know, it's like that's what they're probably drinking, moonshine from that, you know. And it's sort of like that's what we think, like, impoverished communities are drinking. But today there's a company in Dallas, Texas, they've been in business for a few years now, that I had them on the podcast. They're called Suti Distillery.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, I've had that or seen it.
Yeah. They're the first Rude distillery in the US. And it tastes really, really good. It tastes really, really good. It's not like the repurposed water bottles that I've had on Yao tables in Vietnam. It's there's a smoothness to it. There's a, you know, there's a fine, refined taste to that sort of Rude. So yeah, you're right. It's just like this, there's so much going on with the history of rice wine.
Yeah. And that's, I actually do remember with Saigonier, we had somebody write an article about them and interviewed them as part of a series looking at diaspora, mostly F&B, kind of what they're doing outside of Vietnam, changing things, returning to old traditions. Yeah. And that was one of them. But I think it really is a trend and a source of, you know, similarity between different places, different countries. Anywhere in the world, you can probably find old traditional things being reappreciated, reformatted, quote unquote discovered by younger people that want to preserve it, and that idea that people are committed to preserving while having to learn about it before they can preserve it, I think is pretty neat.
Yeah, that same company is now getting into whiskey, which is very interesting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah it's pretty brilliant. They gave me a bottle, and I don't want to break the seal because it's like the first batch coming out of the distillery for whiskey. So I'm like, Yeah, it's
you
tough.
Got to convince them to send you a second one. You got to get another one to try.
Exactly. I'm just going to buy it. Yeah. Now, what about this business of whale worship?
Whale worship, that's another kind of topic where just kind of heard a sliver of it. I was looking at a photo competition somewhere. I think it was in a museum, in like the Dong Art Museum, and one of the photos was of a whale, and the caption mentioned whale worship. And I thought, whale worship? I've never even heard of that. And I kind of just put it in the back of my mind for a while, and then brought it up to some friends here in Saigon and said, whale worship, what is this? And I'm like, I don't know. I think people on the coast do that. I don't know. And so when somebody here tells me they don't know about something here, it makes me really want to know. It's kind of that
Yeah.
extra energy to find out. So I, traveled around and talked to some people and did a little more research and explored around a little bit and found that in a lot of places up and down the coast, they have pretty extensive and varied ways to show reverence for whales and kind of attach different, depending on the person, depending on the area, a different relationship with Kaong or the whale god. Often ascribing the god who can be a whale, but also sometimes not a whale, just a big fish. Not all big fishes. They will completely argue. Also, and I was back there doing something with VTV, filming about the whales, and we were interviewing a man, and he was saying, "Yeah, they can have tails that are like this, or they can have tails that are like this." Which, if like, what scientifically, no whales have tails. Like that's a fish tail. That's not a mammal tail that goes only, this way. But in their concept, no, it's still a whale. So it's a really interesting way to kind of step back and be like, okay, I'm thinking of whales by a very scientific, taxonomical understanding of the word whale. Not exactly the same for whale worship. But some of them will credit the whales with being able to provide calm seas or ensure fortuitous fishing ventures out into the water. Some even told me about a time when they protected them from coast guards because they were fishing in illegal water and they weren't supposed to be there. And the whales somehow drew the coast guard away so they didn't get in trouble. One man I talked to claims to have been physically saved by a whale when he fell into the water and the whale came up under him and picked him up and brought him safely to shore. And when I went back, there were people that were there tending the grave in the exact same way you would tend to a relative grave. So, placing the incense, burning the joss paper, coming back at certain, monthly intervals to pay your respects, and really is a reverence for whales that's I'm fascinated about, and I'm always excited to find things that other people here don't know about. And that's kind of the biggest compliment I can receive is, wow, I never knew about that, or I never thought about it that way, or I never understood it in that perspective.
I'm not going to say this is embarrassing for me, but it's pretty embarrassing that I didn't even know that there's whales in Vietnam.
Well, no, it's a fair reaction.
Let alone whale
Scientists don't even
worship.
know how many there are. Yeah, I mean it's so understudied. There's been no like formal from within Vietnam or outside of Vietnam formal coast, coastal studies on a scientific sense to even know. So it really is kind of just waiting to be explored more to somebody go out there and find more.
Yeah, because it makes me think of like the other cultures that have big whale whales in their culture. I mean, in their religion, in their way of life. I'm thinking of maybe Alaska or places that are
Yeah.
American Indian Eskimo. Like that's sort of what we kind of like equate to, not. Somewhere in the, tropical hot Vietnam, there's whales and, this culture there.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is surprising. And I think part of it, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but compared to maybe some of like, yeah, the Northern Americas and northern areas of Japan, I don't know if Vietnam has the same history of deep sea fishing, of going out for weeks at a time where they would have encountered whales because most of the foundations for whale worship here is based on whales that wash ashore. So that's how they're encountering whales, is the whales that die offshore or get beached and then die here. But yeah, it's pretty crazy to think that actually a friend just told me that off the coast, central Vietnam, I'm going to be off on the city, might have been Nha Trang, they just found a whale. And or it was either a whale or two whales. And of course, like, boats rush out to find it. And now there's kind of some limited debate about if whales are coming here regularly, how do we sustainably develop tourism that can involve whales, right? Because it's, again, it's tricky. You want to be able to let people see whales so you can understand them better, so you can have more appreciation for them as an environmental entity and taking care of the ocean. But if you don't do it well, you're really causing them a lot of harm.
Yeah.
So kind of that balance, if they are coming here regularly, or if there is really that potential to frequently bring people to whales, how do you do it wisely and responsibly?
You know, as I am listening to you talk about the history of rice wine, the Saigon Zoo, whale worship, and we're going to get into a few other things, think about, like, at what point do you stop researching? Because if it was me, I would just keep going and going and going. I mean, how much time limit do you give yourself? Be like, okay, I'm going to draw the line right here, and I'm not going to get more research into this, and I'm just going to present the story to people. Like, where do you stop?
That's a great question. And one, so again, these articles all kind of originated for Saigoneer, for where I work. And that exact thing was happening, where I'd spend months and, you know, our weekly editorial meeting, I'm still researching rice wine. Oh, I've got to interview this professor now. Oh, I need to read this book now. Oh, I need to go here now. And they're like, okay, but you've been working on it for months and you haven't done anything, you know, like, you got it. We're not paying you to do nothing or to do only one. So at some point we initiated a fee for if I was writing things over a certain word length, because then it's editorial resources on their behalf to edit all the damn things, that I have to pay a little extra into the friendship fund that we use to go out and get dinner and stuff, and kind of a, you know, a nice team bonding kind of experience. Because yeah, for me, that impetus to just keep going is endless. I've been lucky to have kind of a structural sense of whether it's loose concepts of deadlines or loose concepts of you have other things that I'm excited to write about. I can't get to those if I keep going on this one, but it's a challenge. And there are things that I've written where I was, man, I wish I had a couple more months on that one. I'd really like to get deeper into it.
Yeah, we share that kind of DNA where, you know, you can go down a rabbit hole with all of these subjects. And I have you know, I've talked about this and it's coming. It's called This Vietnam Life, where I'm doing shorter episodes from like 8 to 12 minutes of things that I'm interested in that have to do with Vietnam. So just like you, but I am terrified of going into rabbit holes and spending months. And, you know, I'm having this problem right now. You know, there's things that I want to look into, and just look into the microphone. I mean, talking to the mic and look into the camera and talk about the subject, but I don't know where to draw the line with where I have to stop researching. And it's really fucking me up.
It's tough. it's frustrating, right? When you have to, for me, the most frustrating part, I'm curious about you, is when something is quote unquote done, or I need to move on from it, and I know there was more there. Like, there were still things that I wanted to explore or learn about or talk about, or, you know, in the context of the podcast, like, you want to ask this person all these other things, but you know you need to cut it off.
That's my biggest pain, is when I stop talking to that person and end the Zoom call, and I go back and I'm like, oh my God, I could have asked that. I could have, and it just, the list keeps building up, and I'm like, all right, well, I did my best. I just have to accept it now that, you know, the 90 minutes to 2 hours or whatever, I try to squeeze as much information or questions as, you know, that's humanly possible. And now I'm just okay with it. But now I'm stepping out into a different format and I'm having trouble because there's just so much to talk about, you know, with these topics.
Yeah. So I guess, do you have to put like an artificial, like 10 minutes, it is 10 minutes hard stop. And that kind of is a way to box yourself into it then, to force you to, against your greater impulses.
No, I let it rip. I let it rip until you gas out. When the guest's energy gases out on that topic, then I do try to organically move forward, and not squeeze out more, because I have a tendency to squeeze more, because all the little details to me are like, they're just so fragrant, you know? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's just so
a little.
Like, I know, you know, for me, and I'm sure there's somebody who's gonna be people who are sharing this whole like, what? We have whales in Vietnam? Of course, we're like, we have water on one side, right? Of course, there's gonna be whales, but then whale worship, and you know, it's just rabbit hole stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what's fun though, right? Like to wake up and know that you, anywhere you look, there's a little thread you can pull and find yourself just racing towards that rabbit hole to go through.
Yeah. Now, these rubber plantations exist all around Vietnam. There, if anybody visiting Vietnam has a chance to walk inside these rubber plantations, just because you can, they're open on the highway. You can just pull in and just walk. Nobody will stop you because they're typically not fenced. I've spent time in the rubber plantations because they're my families and my brother and his in-laws, and they, some of them have plantations. So spending time in rubber plantations have been magical for me from day one, coming to Vietnam. But there's all this other historical stuff that's rather dark, or rather, talk to me about that.
Yeah. I think I might have first come onto rubber plantations, maybe like some other people do, young people, foreigners, whoever, that they see a rubber plantation like the ones you're describing, and they think, oh, that's beautiful. Gorgeous. Like, let's get out and get a selfie, right?
Yeah.
And I've definitely heard people that, like, you know, they'll have pictures up on Facebook or show a picture and it's in front of a rubber plantation. I'll ask them, like, oh, you went to a rubber plantation? They're like, oh, I don't know what that is. It's just really cool looking, isn't it? I say, yeah, it is. It is really cool. And it's got a crazy backstory, you know, and the history of the rubber plantations and how they were used, again, to the theme of how could the French government make money out of Vietnam's, you know, verdant land and soil and people that were of no value to them and that they could exploit and whose lives really meant nothing and were just another small tally on their, you know, profit sheet, as they had to figure out. So that's how the rubber kind of plantations existed here. But if you take it back further, I think you can, the topic has many different themes and subjects, and if you go back far enough, it's really one of human ingenuity, of how we turned a little piece of liquid in a tree that it had developed over millions of years to guard itself against insects, how somebody knew to take that and made a ball out of it to play with, and then accidentally found out that they could cover their like crude coats with it to be waterproof. And then how that somehow goes across an ocean where people, you know, find out that it makes better wheels than what they've been using to cover wheels. And then that, you know, so many stories of human migration, human industrialization, the natural world's evolution. I mean, there's, I think, a lot of truth. You give me any commodity in the world and you can tell almost all the stories of the earth and humanity's place on the earth. And rubber for me is just kind of one of those perfect examples. And a lot, like the history of humanity, a lot of negativity and bloodshed and tragedy.
Before we get into all that dark stuff, I want to literally talk about why rubber. Maybe you know, maybe you don't know, I don't know. But when you go into a rubber plantation, you see a rubber forest. There are diagonal cuts the body of the tree, and the diagonal cuts lead to a bowl, and what drips bowl is white, sappy, gunky liquid. How does that? Do you know how that white turns into black tires? I mean, are they adding black to tires? I mean, how does this work?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know, because you're right. Like, that's the latex is the white that comes out, and that's the natural rubber trees just naturally produce that as protection. And we don't see white tires racing around. I don't know at what point, because I know like they undergo vulcanization, and then like the average car tire is only a certain percentage of rubber. So there's other stuff in there. What that stuff is, I don't know, let alone like the color. So it must be in that process somewhere, but yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
It's white. It looks like Elmer's glue when it comes out of the body of the tree.
Yeah.
And they're not even that big. They're just like maybe like 10 inches wide. I mean, you know, I remember the trees are not that big, but they, you know, they have thousands of these bowls that are attached to the tree. And it's very interesting how it's collected.
Yeah. And it's still pretty rudimentary, right? I mean, you literally are just going out there with a knife and cutting the trunk of a tree and putting a bowl under it. I mean, it's a very labor intensive, basic process that is still being done that way.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful thing too. When you step into a rubber plantation and you think about the history and you think about visually miles, it feels like an eternity where your eyeballs can't see the end of it. And it's just, you're so far down of hundreds of trees, and it's all over Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's become an intriguing part of the landscape, right? If you go on any drive to the countryside, it becomes an important part of that journey, of the visual aesthetics of that area, which I think, are very beautiful.
Yeah. Especially from Saigon to Dong Nai, Long Khan, you know, Dong Nai, it's rubber plantations everywhere, in Vietnam. Yeah. You are at Saigonier. How did you get there?
So Saigonier, it's been around for about 10 years, and I was just a reader when I first came to Vietnam, stumbled across it somehow. And when I moved to Saigon, I really wanted to write for it because I was a fan and it kind of seemed like the perfect place, but they didn't have any need for staff. So I just kind of started doing freelance stuff, just kind of throwing my name in whenever possible and just doing what nobody else wanted to do in terms of article topics, some stuff that needs to get done for like client writing stuff, and just saying, I'll do it, you know, little by little, just showing that, you know, I can write well, I can be accountable, I can answer emails, like, you know, just little by little, and just kind of hanging around until there was some staff changes, somebody left, and was able to kind of get put on full time.
How did you meet the guys?
We've grown, through a friend of a friend who's Alvin, who's a big fan, he listens to your podcast. He's a Vietnamese history student and PhD student in the U.S., and he's one of those people, maybe like yourself a little bit, likes to connect people, you know, likes to know, like, I really like this person. I really like this person. Mm. You might like each other, you know, so kind of setting that up.
And then just showing up.
Yep. And just showing up. And I think if you spend enough time just, you know, working on something, usually you can get somewhere with it, and just having patience.
Yeah. And that's the thing about, I think, my life and many people, like humanity, I think there's a luxury to kind of knowing what you're kind of meant to do and what energizes you and puts you in flow state, right? And there's a small population of human beings that are allowed to do that for one reason or another. Who knows? There's a privilege to arriving at that point where in life you can follow and chase your shit. And it bothers me to think about it a lot, because it's like, well, you know, you get to Vietnam and you meet the guy who introduces you to the guy, and you find flow state, and then you're privileged enough to just keep doing that and not worry about the money, you know, however you're making money. But the luxury of finding, so goddamn, it's just so few of us, you know.
Absolutely. And it feels, I don't know, for me, I don't know if it's the same for you, but for me, I just feel so incredibly lucky. And then also I think about, like, not just as a whole to have that experience you just described, but like the one or two things that had they not gone that way, who knows what different trajectory. So like the translator, my good friend who translated the book, I only met her in person because a friend of a friend needed to get books to her, and I was supposed to put them on a grab and send them to her. And I sent the wrong ones. I had a backpack full of books. I pulled one out. I put the wrong one in. didn't, you know, so she messaged me and she said, hi, you know, I'm the person you were sending books to. What the hell did you just send me? So, oh, shit. Okay, I'll send it right. She's like, if you're close enough, why don't you just bring it in person? I think because she may have thought, like, this idiot doesn't know how to properly send a book. Like,
wow.
So she invited me over and we got to meet in person. Had I sent the right book, maybe I never would have met her in person. And then, you know, that whole spiral out, who knows where that goes.
Wow.
So I just feel so incredibly lucky to have so many of those little things that are beyond anything I've done or any reflection on my own anything, just luck. And I'm very fortunate.
Makes you think, like, this big universe, you know, is it luck or is it like quantum physics happening in favor of, like, whatever we're putting in, you know, whatever we're putting out in the universe, you know, because things show up and they just kind of like situate themselves and allow you to kind of like, but you have to kind of, and that's the thing, this, like, this idea of like prayer in religious sort of like traditions where you pray, but is it another way of saying, well, quantum level, you're kind of putting out vibrations to bring in these things into your, calling it into the existence.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess I'm curious then too, like, how concepts of karma play into that. You know, what are you putting out there that results in things coming back in your way?
It's got to be the same system, right? It's all kind of like,
yeah,
thousands and thousands of years of observations of gurus or priests or whoever these people are kind of like documenting this stuff. It's like, that's sort of like, no matter what religion, you know, you always sort of get the same system, it feels like.
Yeah, I think it's been discovered, quote unquote, discovered enough times in enough different contexts that there's got to be something to it if that's the yeah. lessons that are being repeated over and over.
So this fascination with Vietnamese lit, why do you think you're so into it? What draws you into Vietnamese literature?
I mean, I think the better question, to be honest, would be like, why literature? Because I think Vietnamese literature, because I'm in Vietnam and I have the opportunity to meet with and have friends that are Vietnamese. So what, you know, it makes sense that we talk about Vietnamese literature and foreign, you know, whatever literature, but it's just, I think Vietnamese literature in part because that's where I am and I'm friends with Vietnamese writers. So that's kind of maybe that's why Vietnamese literature. And I think there's maybe an added layer that you don't find in literature elsewhere that you find in Vietnamese literature for a few different reasons. One, just the length of history and tradition that underscores Vietnamese literature versus, you know, well, if America's only existed as a concept, how long can American literature have existed to develop all these traits and traditions to build off of or play with or play against or play towards or all these kind of traditions? And then I think, in some sense, it's excitement in a very neutral term of excitement kind of produces great works. And without saying good, bad, or otherwise, Vietnam has had some exciting decades for quite a while. And I think that's resulted in kind of interesting literature, interesting things to explore within literature. And maybe a lot of places in the world could have similar conditions.
Are you into other?
Yeah, I think.
Are you into other forms of literature?
Yeah, I mean, so my main background is poetry, and that's mostly American poetry. I still Vietnamese poetry. I think when I consider what fluency means, you know, there's different layers of fluency, yeah. right? There's being able to converse with somebody. Maybe that's a layer, or the most basic layer, being able to go and order something at a restaurant. You know, then you can read a newspaper. You know, that's a layer of fluency. You can watch a movie without needing subtitles. That's a level. I would contend and put forth that the highest level of fluency would be to read a poem in a language that you're not native to. Like, that's the highest level of being able to, because you need everything, right? You need context. You need weird words. You need to understand rhyme and rhythms if they're playing with it, and form. Like, there's so much going on there. And that's all to say that I can't read Vietnamese poetry. That's way beyond my ability to read untranslated poetry.
You
That's
know,
the goal. That's the eventual goal, but I got a long way to go.
You bring up a good point, because you need to know the words, you need to know the syntax, you need to know all these rules, right? But you also need to know that wherever abstraction or abstract thoughts take you, that it actually makes sense in that language. Because you could be like, oh, I could, you know, kind of like imagine this to mean this, but it's, that won't make sense in the Vietnamese world. So you have to kind of have some contextual understanding of what things mean for Vietnamese, because otherwise your abstract mind won't be able to go there. It'll go there in American way, or maybe because you're influenced by, you know, Russian lit, you know, you study too much Irish literature, so you're like basing your kind of abstract thoughts on different structures. But Vietnamese might, well, specifically Vietnamese might be something totally different. So I think that's another thing in the tool bag that you kind of have to have beyond just the vocab or the way things are put together.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And even if you could be fluent in a language, I would argue you're a native speaker in a language and not be able to read poetry in that language,
totally.
Or not really, quote unquote, understand it or not get anything personally from it. Or, you know, I know in Vietnamese classes, I get in trouble with my tutor because she always says, you can't say that. I'm like, well, why not? It makes sense. She's like, yeah, but you can only say that in poetry. And that's like her insult. It's like, you can only say that if you're writing poetry. Otherwise, people don't know what the hell you're talking about. Only poets say that kind of stuff. So it's fun, right? It's a fun way to think about it and play with it. But
are you pretty fluent, like conversationally, or when you go out to?
I can get by, but I'm not. No, I'm not as good as I should be for how long I've been here. It should be a lot better, but getting better little by little. Something always to work at.
How much longer are you going to stay in Vietnam?
I have no plans to leave. I mean, I'd like to stay here. There's no, I guess, more definite way than saying I have no plans to leave and I'd like to keep staying here. I've never had that thought cross my mind of leaving.
And what about family, like your mom and dad? Do they ever say come home to the United States or anything?
I'm super blessed with my parents. Are wonderful and go find happiness, do good in the world and be happy. And of course, missing me and wanting me to come back, of course, but also realizing that you have to do what you want to do. You have to find your own way in the world in terms of what you find happiness and satisfying. And they'll come to visit and kind of take an interest, of course, with what I'm doing. But thankfully, they're not in any way pressuring of like, okay, when are you going to come home now? When are you going to move back?
You got good parents for sure. Not just for what you just said, but the way you've turned out. I mean, beautiful. You're a beautiful person.
That's credit to them. Credit to them.
Paul, how much work do you have left? I mean, what kind of work do you kind of want to set for yourself while you're in Vietnam?
Oh, man. I mean, so if we go off the last question of, you know, if I ever plan to leave, part of the reason would be no, because there's no running out. Finishing everything is impossible. There's lifetimes of things that I'd want to be able to do. Endless things to write about. Again, we talk about how any single object is a story. You can walk down the street and find a story everywhere. So I don't think it'd be possible to run out of things to write about. Hopefully, as my Vietnamese continues to improve, I work with translators to translate novels. So just continuing that. I mean, there's endless novels in Vietnamese that haven't been put into English yet that need it, that the world stands to benefit from being able to read. And then there'll be new people coming along that have works that need to be translated. And then my own work being, you know, so inspired by Vietnam to write my own poetry or creative things or take on projects. So, yeah, no end possible.
Paul, I look forward to years of knowing you and getting to read more of your work. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Likewise.
Really appreciate
Thank you so much
time.
For having me.
Of course, of course.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.